Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Brian Lynn, and John Russell. Later, Anna Mateo will bring us this week's health report. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Iraqi Kurdish leader Masoud Barzani has announced that he will step down as president on November 1st. Barzani made the announcement on television Sunday. The autonomous Kurdish regional government has faced strong criticism after it held an independence referendum last month. A number of Barzani's supporters forced themselves into the parliament building as lawmakers met to approve the president's request. They attacked lawmakers and reporters while a crowd outside parliament waved Kurdish flags. Barzani said he wants the position of the president to be dissolved and its duties spread between the Kurdish area prime minister, parliament, and the judiciary. During his speech, Barzani said the Iraqi central government has used the Kurdish vote in September as an excuse to retake territory. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and coalition forces had controlled the territory in northern Iraq for years after they pushed out Islamic State, or IS, militants. IS fighters had overrun large areas of northern Iraq in 2014. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi is calling for calm and respect for the law after Barzani's announcement. Abadi said he was following developments in the Kurdish area closely. He said the central government in Baghdad wants to establish safe conditions in every province and protect the interests of every citizen. The United States called Barzani's decision an act of statesmanship during a difficult period. In a statement on Monday, the State Department praised Barzani as a historic figure and courageous leader of his people, most recently in our common fight to destroy ISIS. James Jeffrey is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former diplomat. He told VOA that Barzani's move could ease concerns of the Baghdad government and of Turkey, Iran, and other countries opposed to Kurdish independence.
If he steps down, then that will open the door to the step of annulling the referendum vote, because that is the demand of both the Abadi government in Baghdad and all of the neighbors.
The referendum in September resulted in 92% of Kurds voting for independence from Iraq. Barzani said the vote was meant to provide a way to find a peaceful solution to the governing of the Kurdish area. He said any separation from the central government in Baghdad would be put off for years. Kurdish leaders had offered to suspend the referendum results and to start talks with the central government, but Abadi rejected the offer. He has said he would accept only a cancellation of the referendum and respect for the country's constitution. As a result of the vote, Iraqi central government forces took control of the city of Kirkuk and surrounding areas from Kurdish forces. The two sides are currently negotiating control of border posts, including areas where an important oil pipeline crosses into Turkey. Masoud Barzani has been president of the Kurdish regional government since 2005. However, his second term ended in 2013. It was extended because of fighting with the Islamic State militant group. But Parliament had not acted on a further extension in recent years. I'm Mario Ritter.
Something unusual happened in Somalia after the bomb attack that killed 358 people on October 14th. Many Somalis went quickly to hospitals to donate blood for the victims. There was a great need for blood to help people after the bombing in Mogadishu, the capital. Hundreds of people were wounded in the attack. But in Somalia, blood donations are not very common. Many Somalians do not want to give blood because they are afraid of sharp needles or concerned they might catch a disease. Others believe there might be religious restrictions on donating blood. For these reasons, Somalia has lacked blood banks for more than 20 years. This made it difficult for hospitals to treat victims who had lost large amounts of blood. When the bomb exploded, doctors in Somalia immediately contacted hundreds of people who had pre-registered as blood donors. They also launched a social media campaign, including a Facebook page, to seek out new donors. Omar Habib completed medical school at Benadir University in Mogadishu. He says the Facebook page got over 500,000 views on the day of the bombing. Then, hundreds of people voluntarily poured into the hospitals to donate blood, he said. Many of the blood donors were sent home because hospitals were not prepared to store the blood they did not need right away, Habib said. But these would-be donors were registered to be contacted in the future when blood is needed. Najma Ali Molim is another young doctor in the group. She was among the first medical workers to arrive at the site of the bombing. The fact that the country has no blood bank and that we have seen patients dying because of loss of blood, including children, pregnant women, and gunshot patients, we have decided to stand up and ask our people to donate, she told VOA. Mohammed Adan Jama is a young medical student who was among the blood donors. She says blood is the most valuable thing a person can donate. And for me, it means saving a life, saving the life of a brother or sister, Jama said. Religious leaders and health officials are also using information campaigns to tell Somalis there are no religious restrictions on giving blood. In addition to their work on blood donations, the doctors' group is supporting another social media campaign that is raising money for families of bombing victims. I'm Brian Lynn.
During the 20th century, the United States built many bunkers, underground shelters that could save people during a nuclear war or other crisis. Now, the U.S. government is using one of those shelters for a happier purpose, storing movies, television shows, and audio recordings for future generations. The bunker was once under the control of America's central bank, the Federal Reserve. It stored money and other materials in the case of a crisis. About 10 years ago, the Library of Congress began using the underground space, which is about 120 kilometers from Washington, D.C. Architects designed new rooms and buildings that workers added to the existing structure. The bunker is currently known as the Library of Congress Packard Campus. The Packard Campus covers an area of about 38,000 square meters, with more than 140 kilometers of shelving for storing the mini recordings. It has 35 climate-controlled areas and 124 individual storage rooms for flammable films. The collection now has over 6 million movies, TV shows, and audio programs. Some of these films, such as The Great Train Robbery, are over 100 years old. George Williman has been working for the Library of Congress for over 30 years. Williman says he has spent the past 10 years working in the underground film archives.
My greatest love has always been early film, silent film, and here I was working with one of the largest collections of early film in the world, and I was like, well, maybe this isn't just an accident. Maybe this is where I'm supposed to be.
When films arrive at the Packard campus, employees examine the recordings and make digital versions. Some movies are damaged because they have been in contact with heat and moist, sticky air. Williman adds to the list of collected movies every day. He notes that the center even has some films you would not expect the government to save. Hollywood remains at the center of the international film industry and a sign of American culture. Its protection is important work for the Library of Congress. I'm John Russell.
This is what's trending today. Two women landed in Japan Monday after their rescue from a damaged sailboat floating aimlessly in the Pacific Ocean. Jennifer Appel and Tasha Fuyava and their two dogs had been lost at sea for almost 6 months. The Navy ship, USS Ashland, rescued them about 1,450 kilometers southeast of Japan. Apel and Fuyava left Honolulu on May 3rd, sailing Apel's 15-meter boat, the Sea Nymph. They had planned for an 18-day trip to Tahiti. However, storms flooded the engine, destroyed the boat's starter, and severely damaged the mast. The women could not use the sails effectively as a result. They tried to return to Hawaii. In June, they got within 1,345 kilometers of Oahu, Apel said. We knew we weren't going to make it, she said. So that's when we started making distress calls. We were hoping that one of our friends who likes to go deep sea fishing and taking people out might have gone past the 400-mile mark and might have cruised near where we would be. The women said they floated aimlessly and sent unanswered distress calls for 98 straight days. The women said they ran out of food for the dogs, Zeus and Valentine, and began sharing their own with the animals. They were thousands of miles in the wrong direction when a Taiwanese fishing boat found them. Apel said she paddled on a surfboard to the Taiwanese boat and made an emergency call. The USS Ashland happened to be in the area at the time to avoid a storm. The ship's commanding officer, Stephen Wasson, said the Ashland traveled 160 kilometers and found the women the next day. Apel told reporters on Friday that they were beginning to feel hopeless when they saw the U.S. Navy ship coming toward them. When I saw the gray ship on the horizon, I was just shaking, she said. I was ready to cry, I was so happy. I knew we were going to live. The U.S. Navy decided the Sea Nymph needed too many repairs to make it seaworthy. So the sailboat was left at sea. The women still hope it will be found and they can repair it. If not, Apel said they wanted to build an unsinkable and unbreakable boat, and set out for Tahiti again. We still never got to see the 20,000 islands, so I think that would be the most fantastic trip for May of next spring, she said. And that's what's trending today. I'm Katie Weaver.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Fear, anger, hate, and sadness. These are four emotions that can affect how we think and how we act. When we are under pressure, mental or physical, our emotions are even more difficult to control. But what if there was a quick and easy plan for dealing with your emotions every time you faced a stressful situation? Well, there may be such a plan. and it involves a grammatical term, third person singular. Teachers use this term when talking about verbs and the form they take with the third person pronouns he, she, or it. Now, an American researcher thinks he may have found a way to help control stress. Talk to yourself in the third person. Jason Moser is a clinical psychologist and neuroscientist. He serves as an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. Moser says that talking to yourself in the third person seems to put a kind of psychological distance between you and your emotions. He thinks this distance is all some people need to control how they react to stress.
Jason doesn't just refer to myself. Jason is the name of lots of other Jasons I've met before, and it has many other references, whereas I and me can only refer to the self. Jason can refer to others, and I think that distance from the self towards others gives people different perspectives that allows them to manage stress better.
Talking to yourself in the third person is like giving yourself advice. Moser uses himself in an example. He does not like flying, but he must fly often for his work. So when he is feeling nervous or afraid during a flight, he talks to himself, only silently.
And what I find myself doing if I use third-person self-talk is that I then start kind of giving myself advice. I start saying, well, you know, Jason knows air travel is very safe, and Jason has been on thousands of flights before with no issue. And so this little bit of psychological distance you gain by using your own name, it's almost as if you're giving advice to somebody else, even though it really does end up being you you're giving advice to.
Moser admits that talking out loud to yourself could look and sound strange to other people. So he suggests using your brain and holding that discussion inside your head. Thinking through that dialogue enables you to use this strategy anytime, anywhere. Moser's research came from his desire, as a mental health expert, to help patients. Moser felt helpless when his patients were unable to use strategies he would suggest to them. He wanted to find a method that people could use easily to control their emotions.
I'm looking for easy and quick strategies people can use to manage negative emotions. In doing therapy with my clients, one of the things that's really frustrating is that many times it's hard to get clients to adopt strategies you want them to adopt, and in large part because they're difficult and they're not exactly easy or intuitive in the moment.
Moser says that simply telling people suffering from depression to think differently is not enough. Brain imaging tests show that it takes great effort for these people to change their way of thinking.
And when you ask people who are anxious or depressed, for instance, to do that, you see that it's really difficult for them to do that. Their brain activity shows you that it's effortful for them. And so I'm always looking for something that's easier and quicker for people to do in the moment.
Moser performed two experiments with other researchers at Michigan State University and psychologists at the University of Michigan. He says they used two kinds of stimuli, and they looked at brain activity in the participants using two different imaging techniques.
Yeah, so our main goal with these two studies was to show that third-person self-talk can be an effortless form of emotion regulation.
In the first study, Moser and his team showed the test subjects troubling pictures. They asked them to think about the pictures using either first-person pronouns or third-person self-talk. Then the researchers examined the brain activity of both groups using an electroencephalogram, or EEG. This is a test that recognizes electrical activity in a person's brain. In the second study, researchers asked the subjects to think of difficult memories, again using first-person pronouns or third-person self-talk. But this time, they looked at the brain activity with a different kind of technology, fMRI. Moser says that in both studies, the subjects who used third-person self-talk had a big reduction of emotional response in brainwave activity. The two tests also showed that these participants did not experience higher activity in other parts of the brain. Moser says this shows that the strategy needs no additional effort and happens without any thought or effort.
They had reduced emotional experiences, but no extra effort or extra processing somewhere else in the brain. It seemed to be automatic and effortless.
Moser says he and his team used both imaging tests to give a more complete picture of how the brain reacts to third-person self-talk. EEG measures electrical activity during a short period of time, and fMRI measures blood flow over a longer period. The researchers decided to use two different stimuli in the separate studies for the same reason. One study looked at the strategy used on immediate reactions to a troubling picture. The other study explored the effect of third-person self-talk on bad memories.
In the EEG, we showed them pictures and wanted to see, can they use third-person self-talk in the moment? Whereas in the fMRI scanner, we wanted to see, can we get the same sort of effect using memories about the past?
Moser says this provides a strong case that third-person self-talk is an effective way to control emotions in any situation. He says the most exciting thing he learned from this research is that third-person self-talk is effortless. The brain imaging shows it does not require any added effort, planning, or thinking. And people can use it when dealing with immediate stress or when dealing with painful memories that have long since passed.
This is not hard to do. People can do this, and they can do it quickly within the first second of seeing an emotional picture, and they can do it reflecting back on painful experiences, and that it's really easy and quick to do. And that was really, I think, the kind of main point that we wanted to make with these studies.
Moser warns that this strategy may not be good for everyone. People with a severe mental disorder and who already have too much distance from their feelings should probably not use third-person self-talk. But he believes most other people can use the technique when dealing with stress, depression, anxiety, or anger. Moser admits that the strategy does have its share of critics in the world of psychology. He notes that some may call third-person self-talk silly. However, he adds that this strategy for controlling stress and emotion is not new, but the research is. With the information he and his colleagues have collected, third-person self-talk may be used by more people and in more situations. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.